Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 13 and it's full of fire and brimstone as the 6th Army and the 4th Panzer Army finally arrive in Stalingrad proper. That's when the fighting becomes more personal, with every house and every apartment a stronghold, and skirmishes begin to take place inside different rooms of the same house. By the end of the first week of September 1942, the German 6th Army had come up to the western limits of the city, almost along its whole length, while the 4th Panzer Army was probing the southern limits. The battle proper for the city now began. Ditches and barricades proved no lasting barriers to the weight of German pressure. Only men and women could hold the Wehrmacht back. The air attacks had stopped, for only a freak building here and there stood untouched among the vast devastation. The great blocks of flats, the fine public buildings, were now crazy hollow shells. Civilians were now sheltering in the basements, and some would remain in these gloomy pits until the defeat of the Germans in Stalingrad in February 1943. And it was for this crazy shell of a city that the fiercest of all city battles of the Second World War was joined. For the Russians, its factories could no longer contribute to the Soviet war effort. For the Germans, it was useless as a shelter. Even its strategic value, either for the Germans or the Russians, was now extremely doubtful. For Hitler, as we'll see, it was to become an object of a Führer prestige obsession. For Stalin, it would become the symbol of the ultimate Russian defiance. For the Germans, it would be synonymous with final defeat. For the Russians, it was to mark the beginning of final victory. Last episode, I explained how General Golikov was left behind on the west bank of the Volga, joining General Lopatin, who commanded what was left of the 62nd Army. Golikov had begged to be allowed out of Stalingrad, but Khrushchev, who was the political commissar in command, along with Yeremenko, told him to pull himself together. Lopatin, on the other hand, was a nervous wreck and hardly an ideal leader of men at this moment. Golikov's hysteria also reflected the increased tendency among Soviet personnel to leave the city. Thousands of officers and men sought the sanctuary of the east bank of the Volga and reached it, some through forging their papers, while others hid on board the ferries steaming back and forth. They gambled on making it past NKVD green hats, as they were known. Back at his Tsaritsa Gorge bunker, General Lopatin was trying to rally his dispirited soldiers, but how could he rally? The army had struggled back into Stalingrad, chased by the Germans, having been badly battered west of the Don River. Its front extended from the tractor factory to the grain elevator, and now faced the far more powerful weight of the oncoming Germans. To understand just how weak the 62nd Army was, how about some stats? By the first week of September, an armoured brigade could only muster one tank. An infantry brigade had just over 600 soldiers listed as active, but only 200 were riflemen. A regiment, which should have mustered 3,000 men, was reduced to 100 men. And a division next to this regiment, which was originally staffed by 10,000 troops, was now reduced to 1,500. And on the southern edge of the city, facing the German 4th Panzer Army, the once great 35th Guards Division had a paltry 250 men who could still fight. So General Lopatin phoned Yeremenko, who was now on the east bank in his new headquarters, and told his Russian commander there was no hope of saving Stalingrad. Lopatin had lost his nerve. Now he was to lose his job. Yeremenko and Khrushchev had to find a suitable replacement for Lopatin. They sifted through candidates' names and settled on General Choikov, the deputy commander of the 64th Army. Choikov had been born a peasant and worked as a bellhop and a shop apprentice before joining the Red Army during the Russian Civil War. When Hitler invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941, Choikov was stationed in Chongqing in China, reporting on the palace intrigues around the Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek. Choikov arrived back in Russia in the spring of 1942 and had been working in General Shumilov's 64th Army as it fought the German 4th Panzer Army southwest of Stalingrad. Choikov was built like a street fighter, and his pugnacious character matched his physical appearance. He had a grizzled look with unkempt hair that fell across his face and a row of gold teeth. But before Choikov had time to take over, the German 51st or Allied Corps attacked at daylight on the 7th of September, and within 14 hours had stretched its line eastwards to Razgulyayevka station, which was within 5 miles of the most important feature dominating Stalingrad's skyline, Mamyev Hill. I explained last episode how initially Seydlitz and his chief of staff went to Paulus's army command post with a proposal to drive into Stalingrad on the 8th, or at least the next day, the 9th. But Paulus was once again extremely nervous about his northern flank and ordered Seydlitz to remain loose rather than tied to any specific attack. Paulus was convinced that the 51st Corps would have to be redeployed to his left or further north of Stalingrad. After a day's pause, Soviet counterattacks then began to pressurize the 14th Panzer Corps on their north front. Still, the 51st Corps began pushing northeast against an enemy who was reportedly tenaciously defending every single bunker. By the 10th of September, Hoth's effort to free his flank had a notable success, and that was on the morning when the 29th Motorized Division got a battalion through to the Volga at the southern Stalingrad suburb of Kuprushnoye. As I explained, the 29th lost the half mile of the riverbank during that night, and the fighting along this all-important stretch of land alongside the Volga continued all the way through to the 14th of September. But the 10th of September was the darkest day yet for Soviet defenders. During the day, the 4th Panzer Army drove a wedge between 62nd and 64th Armies, which isolated the Russian 62nd Army inside the city. Stalin, who had been ordering repeated attacks, eventually agreed with General Zhukov's assessment that on the north front, further attacks with the same troops and the same dispositions would be useless. Moskalenko has pointed out after the war that a tactical success had not been possible at any time because his commanders had underestimated the German strength and because the Germans knew that after the 5th of September they only had to concentrate on one army, the 1st Guards. Yet, these attacks did throw Paulus off balance and bought Stalingrad time. On the morning of the 11th of September, Hoth told commanding officer General Der Panzergruppen Werner Kempf of the 48th Panzer Corps to start into the south quarter of Stalingrad the next day and to take it piece by piece. Meanwhile, Choikov was ordered to the east side of the Volga to be briefed by Khrushchev and Yeremenko. The pugnacious general hurried to the main ferry landing in Stalingrad. Choikov thought he'd visit the first aid station and was furious by what he found. Men with grievous wounds were lying on the floor, their blood-soaked bandages unchanged for hours, some for days. They had no food nor water. "Why?" he yelled at doctors and nurses, who merely shrugged. They had not slept for days and were beyond exhausted. Choikov realized nothing could be done, so he went to sit in an American Lend-Lease Willys Jeep, brooding about the upcoming fight. A cold morning broke on the 12th of September, which was further notice to German soldiers that they may end up fighting through another Russian winter, something they all dreaded. At 10 on the same morning, Choikov presented himself to Yeremenko, saying, "General Choikov has arrived according to your order." Yeremenko offered Choikov breakfast. The stocky man refused. When Yeremenko offered Choikov the post of commander of the 62nd Army, "What do you think of that?" said Yeremenko. Choikov appeared genuinely startled. He muttered, "Vi etam etnoshini," excuse my Russian, which means "in this respect," and was a phrase Choikov loved using. Eventually, Choikov agreed, but he had one proviso. Yet Yeremenko and Khrushchev would not deny him any request for help when he asked for it. All agreed. Time for Choikov to dive back into the melee that was Stalingrad. Meanwhile, the German command of the 6th Army was also on the move. Paulus had flown more than 500 miles west to Vinnytsia in the Ukraine. This is where Adolf Hitler had sent up his bunker. Paulus had been transfixed by the left flank along the Don River, where Germany's allies, including the Romanians, were holding the line. The German 6th Army commander wanted Hitler to send him additional units to bolster the Romanians. Hitler nodded, then asked when Stalingrad would fall. Paulus said, "A matter of days." Then Paulus and Halder had dinner over a bottle of good wine, where the topic of the north flank came up again. Halder promised to pressurize Hitler in the coming days to consider beefing up the northern units. The Germans attacked again on the 12th of September as Paulus visited Hitler, with the 51st Corps moving eastwards towards downtown Stalingrad. They found the going extremely difficult and became stuck outside Orlovka, with Russian counterattacks taking place repeatedly until close to midnight. Paulus had told Seydlitz, to turn the line around Orlovka over to the 14th Panzer Corps and to get ready to strike to the Volga on the 13th. Hoth, who commanded the 4th Panzer Army, told Weichs at about the same time that the attack was going to take a while because fighting was more rigorous than any of the troops have yet experienced in this war. Vasily Chuikov came ashore in Stalingrad and rushed to Tsaritsa Gorge HQ. It was empty. Soldiers on the streets told him the new command post was on Mamyev Hill, and he drove through wrecked streets, appalled at virtually everything he saw. The flimsy anti-tank defences, for example, which he knew would be rolled over in seconds by the highly effective German panzers. But there was something else he noticed. The leaves had fallen from the trees early this year. It was autumn, and growing colder by the day. Eventually, Chuikov located the new 62nd Army command post, but it was basically a trench with a bench in one corner, which was his bed. Overhead were poles with brush, which was hardly any protection against the weather, let alone shrapnel. There was a woman radio operator and an officer sitting in the other corner, yelling down a telephone line. Chuikov introduced himself to his second-in-command, General Nikolai Krylov, who showed him the tactical maps. The arrows indicating the German movements caused Chuikov to reflect. The German 71st and 295th divisions were less than half a mile away from where he was. What was their first target, he thought. He didn't have long to find out. At 6:30 on the morning of the 13th of September, the German 51st Corps artillery opened up from behind Raskolyayevka station. In the wake of the barrage, the German infantry attacked from the northwest, its left flank aimed at Mamyev Hill, its right following the Tatar Trench, another feature of ancient and indeterminate origin. By nightfall, the Germans had made it into the woods west of the hill and at the terminus of the Tatar Trench, where the built-up area of the city began. Chuikov knew he was exposed in Mamyev Hill and ordered his command post to be shifted back to the Tsaritsa Gorge HQ. At least, it was a proper bunker with 40 feet of compacted earth overhead. The only major problem was it put the command of the all-important 62nd Army right between the 51st German Corps and the 48th Panzer Corps that were aiming for a meeting on the river. He would be surrounded by the enemy and soon. And a day later, the situation worsened. The 14th of September turned into a dark day. In the south quarter, the 48th Panzer Corps reached the railroad station and forced a spearhead through to the Tsaritsa Gorge. North of the river, 51st Corps rammed two divisions abreast into the centre of the city. By 1200, it had the main railroad station, and at 1500, reached the Volga at the waterworks. The German 71st Division entered downtown Stalingrad across a two-mile front. One of the men we'll hear about through the series is Captain Gerard Munch. He personally led the 3rd Battalion, 194th Infantry Regiment, as it tried to cross several city blocks and reach the Volga River front. So far, his battalion had avoided large-scale losses, suffering more from heat exhaustion and the occasional Russian rearguard ambush. He told his men they'd be at the river by nightfall. Things were going to change, and quickly. Once the battalion reached the congested avenues of the city, his casualty rate escalated. Russian snipers, many of them women, were hiding out in the third and fourth floor windows and riddled his battalion. Worse, the Russians had posted artillery in these apartments, and from their vantage points, they blew gaps in the German columns. The Germans ironically found fewer places to hide, although there was much rubble lying about. Despite suffering constant casualties, the 3rd Battalion closed to within a few hundred yards of the main railway station just off Red Square by 2 p.m. on the 14th. Moinch then received new orders. The 3rd Battalion was to rush to the main ferry landing, and he believed his men would fight through to this strategic location by the evening. He had reason to be confident despite more and more of his men dying around him. The 3rd Battalion had just captured several Russian couriers running through the streets with handwritten messages. Apparently, the Russians were unable to communicate with each other as they did not use radio much and relied mostly on telephones. But most of the lines were down, so they resorted to the forked stick method, as ancient as it was. Obviously not quite a forked stick, but you get the analogy. By sundown on the 14th of September, the Corps held almost a mile of river, and anti-tank guns set up there had sunk two ferries and a steamer. Chuikov, meanwhile, was facing one of the most critical 48 hours of this entire battle. He was in a desperate situation, despite receiving word that the 13th Guards Division would cross the Volga that night to reinforce his position. But he had a problem to solve before then. At 4 o'clock, the NKVD garrison commander arrived. Colonel Sarayev considered himself indispensable and was refusing to carry out the army's orders. General Vasily Chuikov sized up the NKVD radical and said,
"Do you understand that your division has been incorporated into the 62nd Army and that you accept the authority of the Army Military Council?"
Sarayev looked annoyed and grumbled, but Chuikov stopped him short.
"Do you want me to telephone the Front Military Council to clarify their position?"
Sarayev wilted under the ultimate threat facing Yeremenko and Khrushchev and buckled.
"I am a soldier of the 62nd Army," he confirmed.
General Chuikov now showed what an astute commander he was. He needed Sarayev's 1,500 well-armed and highly trained militia. The plan he'd come up with was first conceived on the steppe when Chuikov watched enemy blitzkrieg tactics against his former 64th Army while he was 2IC. The idea he had was pretty simple, but it meant throwing away the Red Army textbook on tactics. He broke up Sarayev's militia into small squads of 10 or 20, and then sent them into the most strategic buildings in the city. This created a number of mini fortresses commanding various street intersections. They also acted as a kind of breakwater, funneling the Nazi panzers into approach roads already registered by Russian artillery. When the tanks lumbered into these traps, they faced murderous fire from heavy weapons. As these exploded and burned, the German troops behind were exposed and close-range fighting developed where the Luftwaffe could not offer ground support. This single tactical change was a masterstroke of observation and flexibility. Chuikov had managed to find a simple solution to a complex problem. He'd threatened the main person who'd have refused to conduct the defense through such a clever trick, Sarayev, then used the fanatical NKVD militia in the best possible way. It would be 60 NKVD soldiers, not more than half a mile from Chuikov's bunker, who'd manage a minor miracle later. Its commander, Colonel Petrakov, had been knocked unconscious early on the 14th by a German shell which exploded close by, and he was now lying in a tunnel on the edge of the Volga. Petrakov regained consciousness and his men reported the situation. Germans had rushed for the river and taken a series of buildings against the shore. These included the House of Specialists, which was actually an apartment built for engineers, the five-story State Bank, and the beer factory. You could hear the Germans shouting, "Rus, Rus, Volga, Bul, Bul," which means Russians will drown in the Volga. By now, Petrakov knew that the 13th Guards Division was to arrive that night, but that was hours away. At that moment, the luck they needed arrived in the form of a small boy. "What's your name?" asked Petrakov.
"Kolya," replied the boy. It turned out the lad had been recruited by the Germans to spy on the Russians.
Kolya told Petrakov exactly who the Germans were. The 1st Battalion, 194th Infantry Regiment, 71st Division, commanded by Captain Gindeling. He was protecting Gerard Moinsch's left flank, and their aim was to sweep up to the main ferry landing before dark. So the Russians knew exactly where the Germans were heading. As dusk approached, Captain Gindeling sent his 1st Battalion troops forward towards the ferry pier, 750 yards away. There, they found Colonel Petrakov's 60 men waiting. The small band had formed themselves into a skirmish line around the landing, and they were ready for the Germans. Chuikov had heard of the predicament of Petrakov and ordered a fast motorboat to deliver a large amount of ammunition and grenades to him. The Russian colonel had also discovered a 76mm gun on a side street and quickly taught himself how to use it. So now Gindeling's 1st Battalion was approaching and a brutal battle developed. Colonel Petrakov was firing his new 76mm gun straight at the State Bank, blasting a hole through the concrete wall. It was growing dark and the Russians actually launched a counter-attack as the 13th Guards arrived. The first man off the boat was Colonel Yelin, the commander of the Guards 42nd Regiment. He plunged into the Volga, but it was only knee-deep at that point, and he led his men straight towards the State Bank building. Petrakov stopped firing, and the Russians were going to get into a little hand-to-hand fighting with the Germans stuck in the bank. It was not apparent to the Russians, but at this moment, the German attack was wilting.
While this was happening near the ferry pier, close to the railway station 500 yards away, Captain Mensch had a real problem. Most of his battalion was now dead or wounded. Over 200 of his men lay in the streets leading up to the station. So he called an airstrike by Stukas, and for once, the much-touted Luftwaffe fluffed their orders. Many of the bombs missed the station and landed amongst Mensch's men. Friendly fire killed around a dozen more. Mensch conducted a headcount as they dug in around the half-constructed and U-shaped government house, and he realized there was no way he'd make it to the Volga that day. Back at the ferry pier 500 yards away, two entire regiments and one battalion of the 3rd Guards had managed to land their boats through the German shellfire. Some stumbled about, lost, but in the end, they formed a strong defensive line by dawn of the 15th of September. When the report of events reached Stalin, he was conferring with Zhukov and Vasilevsky in the Kremlin, and the topic of the day was Stalingrad. Stalin had ordered the 13th Guards into the battle, now 10,000 fresh men and women who had dug in around the Volga bank. And they were led by a hero of the Soviet Union, General Major A.I. Rodimtsev. As dawn broke on the 15th of September, Rodimtsev arrived on the east bank to be ferried across to join his men clinging onto the west bank around the pier. He was in his mid-30s and a veteran of many battles, first as a volunteer named Pablito Gechos in Spain in 1936, when he'd fought with the loyalists against Franco. Now he saw the city of Stalingrad burning brightly and his men crossing as the spouts of water exploded around their boats. The Germans at one point scored a direct hit on a Russian ferry boat with 60 men on board. The craft was also carrying a large amount of ammunition and shells, and the massive blast caused a 100-foot-wide arc of water. When the fountains fell back into the river, the entire boat had disappeared, along with the men, blown to smithereens. It was now clear the Germans were trying to seize 3 miles of riverfront from Tsaritsa Gorge in the south to Mamyev Hill in the north. And it's the extreme fighting around this hill we'll hear about next episode. We'll dig in ourselves at this point. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you have the inclination. You can also contact me through the website abwarpodcast.com or direct message me on Twitter @DesLatham. Until next, goodbye.